looks like it's gone. So I put that there. So we can start with basic information. So what was the date and place of your birth is the first question.
Why is that important?
We want to like place everything in like a context of like time and social movements. But if you don't want to share, like that's okay too.
Oh, okay. I was born in the 50s.
Okay.
So that would tell you that I grew up, really came to consciousness during the 60s. So I was very much aware at that time of a number of movements that were in process that really gained a lot of momentum. The women's movement, civil rights movement for African Americans, and also for American Indians as well.
Mm-hmm. How do you... And again, you don't have to share if you don't want to, but how do you designate your race or ethnicity?
I'm American Indian, okay. And I am specifically Sichangu Lakota, or Rosebud Sioux.
Could you spell those for me, in case, so I don't misspell them on anything?
S-I-C, Sichangu. I'll spell it for you. S-I-C-A-N-G-U. Okay. It's hard to say and hard to spell.
Sichangu.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's a foreign language.
Yeah. It's pretty sounding, though. Yeah. I like it. Do you have any siblings?
I do. I have two younger sisters, and I'm the eldest.
Oh, I'm the eldest, too. So you're the oldest. Do you have, like, a partner or spouse?
I do.
What is their occupation?
My husband Mark is an attorney, but he is now teaching law at CBTC.
Oh, that's very cool. So that's very cool.
He still practices law, but he pretty much does that on the side in his spare time.
Very cool. Do you have any children?
No, we've got pets, many pets.
I like that. Where did you attend school?
I attended school in several different places. Grade school in Carson City, Nevada. And then I went to high school in Indiana. My father's from Indiana. My mother is from South Dakota.
You went to college because you're a professor. What did you get your degrees in?
My undergraduate degree is in English education. Mm-hmm. And my minor was in world history. My master's degree is in English literature, and my PhD is in English and American literature with a minor emphasis in rhetoric and composition.
That's hefty. I like it, though. Is there anything else that you wanted to share about your general background? No? Okay. So we can move on to, like, stories from childhood and adolescence, so the next kind of section. Could you describe your relationship with your parents and siblings as you were growing up?
I was close to my siblings. My parents, we were kind of latchkey children because both of my parents worked. And so being the eldest, I was, of course, in charge of of taking care of my sisters. So we didn't get to see them a lot, really, because they were usually working.
What was the community like where you grew up, your community and neighborhood?
Well, I grew up in several communities. Probably the one that made the greatest impression was the little community in Indiana, where we lived. It was a very tiny, 150 people.
That is tiny. Mm-hmm. You said that you went to elementary school in Nevada, mm-hmm. and then like high school in Indiana?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Was your family connected to either community?
My mother was more connected to the Carson City community. When she graduated from college, she originally wanted to go back to Rosebud Reservation, which is where she was born and where she wanted to live. And she had a conversation with one of her uncles, Uncle Moses Red Owl, and Uncle Moses advised her to not come back because there were no jobs on the reservation. And she had a college degree, so she decided to move to Carson City. She took a bus. I mean, it was quite brave of her to take a bus across the country, well, from Haskell. Haskell is now Haskell All Indian Nations University, from Haskell in Lawrence, Kansas, all the way to Carson City, Nevada. And then she moved in with her aunt and uncle and got a job there.
So she went back to the reservation anyway?
No, she went to Carson City to live with her aunt and uncle rather than go back to the reservation.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay. What values did you learn from your family or other people in your community?
I think the value of education, certainly, and education as being my survival. Education is being my survival, and my father was adamant about all three of us. During the 60s, it was not uncommon for young women to drop out of high school and get married when they were 16 or 17, and he very much was against our doing that sort of thing. He said, at least get your high school education, at least do that. Mm-hmm. And so it was that value that I think that we was ingrained in us since the time we were very, very young. My sisters and I always liked to read a great deal. There wasn't a lot to do in our little community. So we were very appreciative to have the local bookmobile come. So the bookmobile would come every week and we would have a chance to load up books to read. And so we read whatever the bookmobile had. So, and all three of us were very, very bookish children. And so it seemed easy then for me to imagine myself as an English teacher because I like to read. And then I made that decision to go to college. So I think that the early seeds of that were formed when I was a child.
Did you always want to be a college professor, or did you just know you kind of wanted to teach English somewhere?
I knew I wanted to teach English somewhere. I thought it would be in high school. When I was in college, I was enrolled in an honors program. And when I was, I think, at the end of my freshman year, one of my professors took me aside and asked me to consider getting a PhD in English. And I was just flabbergasted, absolutely flabbergasted. But there, he sowed those seeds in my imagination that it was possible for me to aim beyond the goals that I had set when I was in high school. So I'm very grateful. If he had not said that to me, I never in a million years would have considered doing what I did or imagined myself here.
That's very cool. Did you learn any lessons from, or different lessons from each parent? Like, the value of education maybe came from your father. Was there anything that you gathered from your mother as a child?
From my mother, a deep respect and appreciation for our heritage, and an appreciation for the burden of that heritage, because we grew up in a time of very great racial intolerance. And so living in a small community, my sisters and I were the only children of color in our school, for instance. And in high school, there were a couple of people of color, but they were very much on the fringes or on the margins. My mother really hated living in Indiana and hated having to live daily with racial discrimination. And that was became, I think, part of our heritage, our having to grapple with that, to come to terms with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Could you give an example of how gender, race, ethnicity, or social class were important in building your understanding of yourself in society?
I would have to say that as I constructed my sense of self, because I do believe that we are all works in progress, and we are, all, you know, in terms of who we are, who we want to be, we are very much a work in progress, very much under construction. I think education was probably key to that, because I set my sights pretty low at simply at survival. But what education afforded me was a sense of broadening my understanding of gender and race, not just as personal lived realities, but as categories to investigate. When I was in college, there was no such thing as a women's studies program. And there were, in fact, very few female professors. And even in my English classes, we read very few women writers. It was very much a white patriarchal world in which I was educated. And therefore, when I look back, I think what strikes me the most is the absence, or that vacuum, that that seems right now to, you know, in the year 2010, really egregious. But our culture was very much a culture in transition and growth and transformation, mm-hmm. for the better, I think.
In the 60s or the 70s?
The 60s and the 70s were times of growth and transformation.
Yeah.
And while I think understanding society came through my appreciation of politics and political movements, because that's what we saw on television. Mm-hmm. And we watched Vietnam on television at supper time, or watched the protests, the war protests, that were staged all over the United States. So that, I think, stood at the forefront of my understanding of society. I saw myself as very much against the war and could position myself in relation to society with that particular position. But I don't think at that point race, gender, ethnicity, or social class really was consciously a part of my identity yet. Mm-hmm. Class, probably. I have to take that back. Class, because class and race are so often intertwined, and especially in the 60s, that was the case, not just for American Indians, but many people of color.
Do you have any memories of being discriminated against or seeing others who are victims of racial discrimination?
Yes, my sisters and I were constantly discriminated against. When we were younger, the high school, and interestingly enough, it would be the high school students. There were some in our peer group, but by and large them, which I thought was, when I look back on it, I find pretty horrendous that high school kids with all the kind of power, social power that they have, that they would make such an effort to express racial hatred and to make us feel so unwanted.
Could you describe any efforts you witnessed or participated in confronting discrimination like that? Or what tactics or strategies you or other people used to maybe combat that?
I didn't have any strategies. I didn't have any resources. I had no tools to work with. And so I think that I coped with it, and reading and books were a way for me to cope.
Mm-hmm. Like almost like an escape mechanism, mm-hmm. you think?
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other memories of your childhood that you feel continue to make a difference in your life?
Oh, there are many. I couldn't even begin to name just one.
I can relate to that. I don't know. I feel like there's lots of different memories that have an influence.
Um,
The next question talks about what significant historical events do you recall most clearly from your childhood and how they affected you throughout your lifetime? And you talked about like Vietnam and the war and that. Did you want to expand on that or give another example?
I was in the fourth grade when President Kennedy was assassinated. And whenever people of my generation talk about that, of course they always say, I know where I was then. Mm-hmm. I know exactly what happened. And it's so interesting that over the years I've heard so many of the similar stories. That made an enormous impression on me because it made an enormous impression on the nation. And I remember also being sick that week. And when I was a child, then the thing about kid bugs is that, you know, when you get the flu, you're down with the flu for a week. Mm-hmm. And so I spent the week on the couch watching all the funeral ceremonies around the honoring and the burial of President Kennedy. My memories after that are punctuated by the assassination of Martin Luther King. That was huge. That was very, very huge. The banality of violence, seeing violence happen in real time on television was pretty stunning in retrospect, because I remember sitting there eating dinner, watching Jack Ruby being shot, you know, Oswald's being shot by Jack Ruby. So that was just odd, you know, it allowed children to be admitted to an adult world was full of violence and danger. Mm-hmm. It was a very serious time to grow up in.
Did you want to share anything else about other childhood experiences or any other stories?
I don't know. Lots of stories.
Was there anything that, like any story that you really like that you want to share, or we could...
Oh, gosh. I'm drawing a blank now.
Drawing a blank?
Yeah.
Well, that's okay. We can move on to the next section, crafting feminist identities. We kind of talked about describing your educational path after high school, going into college. Did you want to describe that any further? If we mentioned it but didn't really go into great detail on it? When you were younger, did you feel like going to college was something that you really wanted to do, since you had that educational kind of pressure, that college was something that was like a given, or you had to kind of be more pushed into it?
I think I had to be more pushed into it because I was afraid leaving a small town and going to a university mm-hmm. that's at some distance and not knowing anyone there really. And my mother had a college degree, but she went away to boarding school, because that's the way that American Indians were educated back in the 50s, was at boarding school, or in this case at Haskell University. And so I have to say that I have been very fortunate, because there have been opportunities and there have been people, really key people, who have stepped into my life at key moments to shape a decision or to offer an opportunity and a little direction about where to go. And those folks they stepped into my path and then stepped back. And it makes me think that everyone comes into our life for a reason. To show us something about ourselves or to help us understand an important choice or the implications of a decision. So I felt very grateful that's been positive for me mm-hmm. in the case of going to college, because the next step after that then was graduate school. And that got easier and easier as I got older and more mature.
Mm-hmm. So going into graduate school, you felt like it was an easier decision to go from college to grad school than high school to college.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And at that point, I felt like I was on kind of a mission. You know, there was sort of a trajectory, I had a path.
Mm-hmm.
I had a path, and it seemed, I never questioned it, except I took a little time out because graduate school was so intense. I'd met my husband, and so I took a leave of absence from my doctoral degree to move to Japan with him, and because he had a job there. He had just finished his master's degree in applied linguistics and teaching as a second language. So we went to Japan. I packed up boxes of books so I could read for my doctoral exams. I worked in a cafe bar, helping people with English, speaking English, and did some teaching in Japan, which was just wonderful. That was such an eye-opening experience for me to step into a bigger world.
Mm-hmm.
And to live around people whose culture was so vastly, in history and beliefs and politics, were so vastly different from mine or the ones that I was familiar with. I love that part. I love that part of my life, of taking that time from a formal education to getting another kind of education.
Mm-hmm. When or how were you awakened to social inequalities based on gender, race, social class, sexual orientation, or any other layers of identity, or just one?
Well, class, gender, and race, ethnicity, as a child, because I was made very much aware of lack of social power and very much aware that I wasn't white. And even in this culture, and I look around at the UW-Eau Claire culture, to be white is normative. To be non-white is therefore deviant,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, that, I mean, it's a logic that's illogical, but as a child, it was a lot for me to have to cope with, because it seemed so patently unfair to me at the time. And what I recall the most is not having power as a child. Not like the kind of power and autonomy I have now.
How do you define power? What does power mean?
Power can be anything. I see power as the ability to manifest something. And that the ability to manifest a will, a sense of direction, a sense of purpose, a sense of accomplishment, setting goals and achieving those goals, protecting myself, ensuring the stability and safety of my life, the ability to make a difference, mm-hmm. in the ways that I can now as a teacher, as an educator.
Do you have any memories of your first encounters with feminism?
Seeing Gloria Steinem on television, on talk shows. And I remember being so impressed with her because, first of all, she was so beautiful. And second of all, she was so brainy.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt enormously impressed at her strength, her personal strength, her sense of direction and integrity. And her fearlessness at speaking at a time when feminism was denigrated in common conversation. And I think to this day that happens to be the case. If I were to go into my English 110 class and ask my freshman women, are you feminists? I'm sure that a fair number of them would say no.
Mm-hmm.
If I go in and ask my women in my senior seminar and ask them that question, I have a feeling a fair number would say yes. So thinking about a feminist identity, I'd never really formalized one for myself, except I thought about the qualities of the women that I admired and that strength and that ability to manifest power, mm-hmm. personal power, for any of the needs and that a person might want to have. I think the first time I really grappled with it was an experience I had teaching at a university while my husband was finishing law school, because I hadn't thought consciously about feminism. I was so much more wrapped up in academia and what I was teaching, mm-hmm. and what I was learning, but I didn't think so much about gender politics, and I wasn't, thankfully, not affected by that. That, to my knowledge, I'm sure I was, not unknowingly, but to my knowledge, I wasn't. I had a conversation in my freshman writing class at this university, and this subject was feminism. I had assigned an essay to read, and it was by Deborah Tannen, and it was about language and gendered language. The response that I got from students, especially my female students, was quite strong. And I remember being struck by that. The university, it was a private university, kind of expensive. And so the women in that class, by and large, came from pretty privileged backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was an interesting response. One woman, though, differed. She was a non-traditional student. She was a mortician. And she was a mortician who made a career change. She decided to go to medical school and start working on the other end, you know, of the process. And she was able to share stories with me and with her classmates about really blatant ways that she felt marginalized in a male-dominated profession of mortuary, mm-hmm. of mortuary science, as a student and then as a practitioner. And would relay anecdotes about being asked to go fetch things, you know, at conferences, to go hand out flyers or to do this or that sort of thing. And she very much resented that.
Mm-hmm. Would you describe yourself? Like, do you identify as a feminist now? Or
I do. And I do because I can... I can comprehend the concept better now than I could when I was a student. I didn't have any engagement with other feminists directly, not mm-hmm. in classrooms, not in social discourse, some with what I was reading. But my focus was not on that. When I returned to a focus that encompasses feminism, it's in the context of talking about Native American women, mm-hmm. and their roles in their respective cultures, their individual cultures. And the debate around gender and race, those debates are framed very differently in Native American studies than they are in feminist studies, I think. Because many Native women, especially women who come from matriarchal cultures, would argue first and foremost, well, we always were feminists. We never really had to focus on equal rights. Our focus, rather, has been on civil rights. Mm-hmm. And our focus has been on the preservation of our cultures and the preservation of our language, racial discrimination against our children, our survival as Indian people, mm-hmm. because the dominant culture almost wiped us all out. In the year 1910, there were only 210,000 American Indians left out of a beginning of 18 to 20 million mm-hmm. when Columbus stumbled into the Americas. So the dominant culture nearly wiped us out. So our sense of survival is heightened. Those are stories that, now that I think about that, that's a story that my mother told us a lot, was about massacres, the Wounded Knee Massacre, the Sand Creek Massacre, you know, reminding us when we were little that were survivors of a race war.
Do you think that, like, really shaped where you wanted to go in your life? Is
certainly shaped my survival instincts.
Mm-hmm. In terms of feminism, how would you describe, like, the niche in feminism that maybe you feel that you fit in?
I don't know that I can respond to that question. I'm not versed in feminist theory, because okay. that's not where I do my research.
Right.
I'm fascinated listening to my colleagues whose work addresses itself directly to feminist theory,
mm-hmm.
and the history of and legacy of feminism, mm-hmm. feminisms.
Right.
So I can't, like I said, I can't really position myself, because I position myself more as an American Indian woman.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense, though. Okay. What meaning does the feminist statement, "the personal is political," mean to you? I'm on number 26, if that helps.
Okay. It becomes political for me if I find myself in a situation where I'm made very conscious of my gender for some reason or another,
mm-hmm.
For positively or negatively.
Do you think that statement might have or ring true, like, with a race or ethnicity identity?
I think so. Because as I, you know, right now I'm teaching a course in American Indian women, and these women are very, very much concerned with the survival of their children and the survival of the community and keeping communities intact. These women understand that they are the culture bearers, that it's their role and their responsibility to make sure that culture survives in the lives of in the bodies and lives of their children and their female relatives.
Mm-hmm.
That's a place where I can really identify with the personal becoming political. As I think about my niece, for example, and her identity as an American Indian woman, which is shaped so very differently. Because she grew up in a very different time than her mother did, or mm-hmm. that I did.
We can move on to the next one. How do you, or how have you negotiated and balanced your identity as a feminist with constraining cultural expectations for femininity or masculinity?
Mm-hmm. I think that I don't know that femininity really pertains. The negotiation, I think, would, if we kind of look back at some of the previous questions,
mm-hmm.
negotiating a position of negotiating a feminist identity in relation to race.
Mm-hmm. How have you, like, balanced those two? Maybe, like, instead of talking about, like, feminism and femininity or masculinity, talking about, like, race in there instead.
I think when I talk to my students about this, or even other feminists of color,
mm-hmm.
I frame it as a social justice issue. I think that it's broader and gets to an important concern of my personal beliefs, or gets a support of my personal beliefs, which have to do with basic humanity,
mm-hmm.
Empathy, kindness, having an open mind and an open heart, and the ability to actually hear what another person who's holds a different opinion or has a different stance on an issue, being able to listen,
mm-hmm.
Ed carefully. But I don't, so in terms of, again, negotiating and balancing and meeting challenges, and maybe I'm being naive, but I do, I guess I do return to, the ideal of social justice, that any kind of discrimination is unjust and inhumane.
What, I'm not sure that the rest of the feminist questions, maybe, I wish we could, like, rephrase them in terms of maybe, like, a race social justice instead of trying to keep it within feminism.
Right.
Because I feel like that's definitely more fitting. So what are your greatest, what have been the greatest challenges you have faced as a social justice seeker?
Prejudice, stereotyping, a real narrow-mindedness on the part of anyone who views American Indians and American Indian women through a particular ideological lens. And that's a big challenge. I mean, not just for me as an American Indian woman, but as an American Indian person. Mm-hmm. That's part of my my passion and maybe one ideal that guides me is that to continually work at chipping away at that ideology or finding ways to, through the way that I teach my students to help them begin to dismantle their ideologies. And that's very, very difficult, mm-hmm. extremely difficult. And an example I'll put out, and this is not related at all to feminism, but is the American Indian logo mascot controversy. Because immediately that's a litmus test. And that tells a person, it tells an American Indian, many American Indian people, where a person's position is. So in the same way that I don't want to be categorized or reduced or discriminated against or marginalized because of my gender and silenced, I likewise don't want to be silenced as an American Indian. Mm-hmm. And that I find really frustrating, and that's an issue of social justice here again. I mean, it's the politics. That's where the politics of gender and race intersect.
Okay. What do you consider the greatest achievements of feminism over the past 25 years?
The traction that women have been able to gain in all arenas, from the family all the way up to the boardroom. I think that women are, because seeing more and more women as CEOs, for example, and quoted in the New York Times, mm-hmm. Profiled in the New York Times, I find that very heartening. And within the family, knowing that there are generations of women who are rearing their sons to think very differently about gender and about their expectations and their relationships with their future female partners. That is huge. It's mm-hmm. absolutely huge. One thing I've said to my younger female friends who are looking for Mr. Right, I'll say, pay attention to how he considers his mother, what that relationship has been like, you know, and if she's been a strong mother, you know, and my husband is a case in point. My mother-in-law is very independent. She's always worked outside the home, and she commands a lot of respect for her intelligence and for her will, mm-hmm. and for her person, who she is, and both of her children. Respect her enormously, and my husband then has always been predisposed to respect women. And I think that that's a real slow, I mean, that's a slow seed chain that happens with each subsequent generation. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm overgeneralizing because issues of class and ethnicity and race, all that will come in and complicate the generalization that I just tried to put out there.
Mm-hmm. What do you think are the most important challenges that feminism has yet to overcome or address?
Conservative ideologies. And especially conservative ideology that's supported by other women, by conservative women. That I find really deeply, deeply troubling. It's one thing for males to presume, to make presumptions about how women ought to, about choices that they ought to make about their lives or their careers or their bodies. But for other women to assume that same role, I find really, really difficult to comprehend. I find it deeply, deeply disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Could you give, like, an example?
I guess an example would be Sarah Palin, who's a public figure. She occupies a platform, and she has managed to amass a certain amount of personal power. And she's using this platform to espouse ideologies that I see really setting 21st century women backwards in terms of even pro-choice issues. It's difficult enough to hear males in the conservative right espouse those positions, but it's very difficult for me to hear something like hear those positions espoused or assumed by her, mm-hmm. because she does have so much influence. And I think that I don't trust that she's responsible enough to use that power with compassion.
Mm-hmm. So you think that feminism, one of their big struggles pushing in to the 2010s, might be to combat those kind of forces? I think I have to agree with you there. So we can move on to the next section, the coming of age as a feminist thinker and activist. So when you think about your life experiences, are there any coming-of-age stories that you think of?
I was reading through your questions, and I was trying to think of that. Because I think that we come of age at all stages of our lives. We come into consciousness. We cross thresholds. And so much of that coincides with where our personal passages are. Mm-hmm. So I could say that, you know, my whole life is a coming of age story. That there are all these embedded narratives that are embedded coming of age stories. So I couldn't really identify one, except to go back to Dr. Brown when I was 19 years old advising me to get a PhD. And as I looked around, there were only two female professors in the English department at that time. And to think that I could join the ranks of the professorate dominated by males was a stunning compliment from him. Mm-hmm. And for me, a real stunning moment where I had to ask myself if I was capable of doing that, of creating that kind of goal for myself and then achieving it. So the passage, you know, the passage of getting my doctoral degree could be linked in some way or another to that passage of coming of age. My personal and my professional identities are so intertwined, especially since I teach American Indian literatures. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm a Native Studies specialist. So it all has married, you know, in very interesting ways, mm-hmm. for me.
So to what extent Did your gender, race, social class, family situations, etc., influence your coming of age experiences or how you see like your life as an ongoing coming of age? How did those other influences influence it?
Oh, I have a coming of age story. I'm going to reduce your question back to, I'm going to pull it back and link it to my ethnic identity.
Okay.
A few years ago, I was at my home reservation at Rosebud, and we were getting ready to have a ceremony. And as so the women have the ceremony, it was a sweat lodge ceremony. And so the women sweat separately from the males. And one of the women I was talking to, Emily Whitehead, just graduated from law school, and she we were chatting, and she, you know, she was so and rightfully so proud of her achievement of going through law school and, you know, and achieving that particular goal, and thinking about that as an achievement not just for herself as a woman, as an individual or as a woman, but as a Lakota person. Mm-hmm. As we were chatting and saying goodbye afterwards, I gave her my business card, and she looked at it. And she knew that I taught American Indian literature, but she didn't know exactly where or who I taught.
Mm-hmm.
And she saw my card, and she said, "Oh, you must be the first Sichangu English professor." And I thought, I had never quite frame my identity in that way, but that was the way she was looking at me. And I thought, that is pretty amazing that maybe, you know, I'm the first person from my reservation to get a PhD. I'm one of the few Sichangu women to do, Lakota women to do that.
Mm-hmm.
There are a handful of us, but the ranks are growing, thankfully. And the ranks of American Indian attorneys, likewise, are growing. So I feel that that was a new way to reimagine myself, I guess, along a passage. To see myself, and this is Emily prompted me to see myself this way, as a role model for other Native women,
mm-hmm.
that they can go on to graduate school and they can get PhDs, and or not only Native women, but Native people generally.
Right.
And I not really thought of myself in those terms until that, consciously, until that moment with Emily, as we were saying goodbye after the sweat lodge ceremony. At our Sundance last summer, I was asked, along with another Sichangu woman, there were only four of us Sichangu women who were going out to take the flags down after the ceremony was over. And Emily was so proud of that, because in the past there would be women from other tribes, but never women who were Sichangu, you know, Rosebud Sioux. And that there are more and more of us who are living and working in a professional world, but yet also coming back and reconnecting with our home places, our ancestral places, is pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
In the picture that is taken of me, there's a picture of me holding a rock. And I took this rock from a pile that had been created after a series of sweat lodge ceremonies. Many people wanting to sweat during the time of our Sundance ceremony. So there are lots of rocks. The rocks are heated in a fire until they're red hot, and then they're put inside the sweat lodge into a pit. And then there's steam that's poured on it and some cedar. And then there's the ceremony that happens inside. And inside, as I'm in the sweat lodge with all these women, we're singing and we're praying together. And we're praying for our loved ones, our family members. We're praying for our communities. And I pray for my students. I pray for myself to be the best teacher I can be, the best educator. And I pray for my students also. To find themselves on the best path personally and academically as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I brought that rock, is because I have had so many, I've made so many prayers over the years for my students. They would be shocked to know that I pray for them. I don't know how they would feel about it happening in that particular context. But that explains why I have a picture of me holding this rock. When I hold that rock, what I look at and what I think about are all the prayers that were uttered in the presence of that rock.
That's very powerful. That's very powerful. In what ways were coming-of-age stories personally transformative for you? Or do you feel that they were personally transformative?
They were never personally transformative for me because in the literature I was teaching, more often than not, the coming-of-age stories were about males coming of age. Mm-hmm. Very few were there about female coming-of-age stories. And I would look around trying to find stories like that. And one of the first ones I ever found was by Linda Hogan. She is a Chickasaw writer. And the story was called Friends and Fortunes. And I started teaching that in English 110. And the coming-of-age story that the female protagonist has concerns violence and the possibility of death. That in her world and in her class, and this is a world in which class and race intersect, that there are more occasions for individuals to find themselves at the receiving end of violence. To recognize that the world is a very violent place, that's an incredible realization for any person to make, but to understand that there are certain populations who are more vulnerable to that violence. It was pretty, you know, the more often I taught that little story to my students, the deeper it resonated for me. Mm-hmm. So in terms of coming of age stories, you know, I've written about it. I've taught around it, that topic as an academic subject, as a theme in literature. Mm-hmm. But I hadn't really internalized any of those stories to apply to me and my personal growth as a person. In the late 20th century, early 21st century, there are more and more Native women writers who are writing coming-of-age stories. I think about Louise Erdrich as a good example of that in the novel The Plague of Doves. And that's a groundbreaking piece of literature in that regard. For Indian people, coming-of-age has to do with the coming to terms with the possibility of not surviving.
Do you think maybe when, because earlier you were talking about how like survival, just basic survival was kind of like a theme early, do you think maybe that realization had anything to do with coming of age?
For me?
Or maybe in hindsight, or?
If so, it would be quite gradual, mm-hmm. You know, sort of a below the level of my consciousness. Mm-hmm. I've always been really aware, as a child even, I had a heightened awareness of my vulnerability as a person because I was a child and I had no power. And because of class and resources, you know, our family never had many resources. So I knew that if I wanted that, I would have to create it for myself. And that would be part of my survival strategy. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like I said, it's subtle.
I personally have kind of a difficult time defining coming of age for myself, too. Like, Like, I feel like it's more gradual. It's hard for me to pinpoint down. So I'm kind of in the same boat.
It's just, it's like the journey. All of a sudden you realize you've arrived at a certain point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I'm kind of in the middle of it. Of like of at least one kind of coming of age. So it's hard for me to look back on anything yet. And so I wonder if that's why I struggle. But I do agree, I feel like it's more of a gradual thing that happens and not necessarily moment.
In the autobiography, Black Elk speaks. Black Elk, as he opens he's telling his life story. And as he begins, he speaks from the vantage point of someone who is elderly. And he says, at the height of my years, I can look back and see the pattern that my life has taken, you know, so I think that getting older does elevate our vantage point. So we mm-hmm. can look back and we can see patterns. We can see the various ways that paths have moved on to different paths, and we can see that pattern, and we can't see it when we're in the middle of it, mm-hmm. which is why passages of transformation can be so unsettling and sometimes even frightening, sort of like a snake is shedding its skin, and at that time the snake is blind because you can't see mm-hmm. until you're already on the other end of it.
Sure.
So it can be painful.
What, if any, celebrations or public events figured significantly as a part of any coming of age experience? Or were there any?
No.
Were there any social scripts that influenced, like, a coming of age experience? I feel like we haven't really found a coming of age experience. So it's hard to kind of go through these questions. How about, what was going on politically and socially at the time of your coming of age? However we want to define that.
I look at the heading of your questions, and it says coming of age as a feminist thinker and activist. Mm-hmm. That has been a gradual, as an activist, I see myself as not so much a feminist activist as a political activist, and my activism happens in the classroom in some very subtle ways, in the material I choose to teach, and the ways that I can help guide my students to talk about and think about issues of race and ethnicity. Because that's always on the forefront of my mind, more so, and forgive me for this, more so than feminism, because the issue of race and ethnicity, where American Indians are concerned, that is itself so volatile mm-hmm. that to factor in the other makes it very difficult. I can do that in a Native Women's Lit course and talk about the ways that Native women have been stereotyped. The Pocahontas, for instance, the Sacagawea figure, and the ways that Native female identities have been fairly circumscribed in American pop culture. And we talk about... we could talk about that in the classroom as a safe space, but even there, it's really difficult for students to sort of see it through, see questions like that through a different lens. So I am an activist. My activism, I think, is embedded in my pedagogy. Mm-hmm. So like I said, so forgive me, the feminism part isn't usually on the front. But, you know, having said that, I do introduce subjects in my classroom. For example, the forced sterilization of Native women. Mm-hmm. And also the routine separation of mothers and children. It wasn't until 1978 that it became against the law to force social worker to step into a Native woman's home and take her children away from her and adopt them out to white families. It was done routinely. Mm-hmm. And even up until the 70s, women were, this is a piece I'm going to teach in my class, I'm going to give to my students tomorrow, women were routinely sterilized when they had their first babies. They were given a form to sign, and they thought that they were told this was a form that would blah, 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 and they would sign away their rights, and they would be sterilized, and not having no comprehension of what it is they were signing or what the implications would be. And that was done routinely because the thinking was that American Indian, there didn't need to be any more American Indians born. And American Indians lived in such a plight that it was inhumane to allow any more people to be born. And so they took away the reproductive rights of thousands of American Indian women. And when I say that to my students, they don't believe me because it sounds so much like Hitler, you know, Hitler's Holocaust. And it was a kind of Holocaust. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can't return to that issue of my being a feminist thinker. It's what I live. But in terms of the way it informs my teaching, I frame the issues a little bit differently. Because I keep going back to social justice.
Right.
Because I think that there's a little less resistance than to frame it as a feminist issue or a racial issue.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that maybe framing something as a feminist issue has, like, rhetorical consequences as opposed to framing it as just a social justice issue?
I do think so. And it depends. Having said that, it depends on the class and the students. Mm-hmm. More mature students tend to be more experienced in life, and they've thought a little more deeply, they've seen more, had more conversations, and have a kind of intellectual flexibility to allow for that kind of conversation. Students who are less experienced or younger really struggle with it and oftentimes tend to shut down. So in terms of the rhetorical possibilities, I'm speaking to myself, you know, and maybe two or three kindred spirits out there. It's a lived reality, you know, the social injustice and racism and sexism. That's a social reality with which some of my students have never grappled with.
Mm-hmm.
Their race has never been an issue for them, and for some of them, their gender's never been an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So to bring those kinds of issues out and to discuss them invites a whole spectrum of responses, if we think about the rhetorical effect of that. But not, I'm repeating myself now at this point.
Mm-hmm. Given what you know now, I'm on number 42. Given what you know now, how would you like to rewrite or reframe any coming-of-age experiences? Or would you?
I don't think I would. Because I think in 10 years from now, I would look back on that and say, and see myself in a different place from where I am right now. It's getting older is an amazing experience. It's just mind-boggling. I tell my freshmen in September, my brand-new freshmen, you will not recognize yourself by the end of this year. By this time next year, you will not recognize the person that you are right now. You will be so indifferent in ways that you hadn't even dreamed of yet. And that's been the case for me personally from, you know, every decade of my life.
Mm-hmm.
So in another decade, I'll maybe look at this conversation as a coming-of-age experience, or where I'm having an insight or an epiphany about something, and it's starting to percolate, and mm-hmm. I haven't really had a chance to reflect on it. I just want to be very open to all experiences mm-hmm. and be open to growth and change.
Maybe not like regret things.
I try not to do things I regret. I try very, very hard. Mm-hmm. 'Cause that's painful. And when I look back on choices that I've made or actions that I've taken that I do regret, I try to see what there is I can learn from it.
Okay. So the next section is about more of the women's studies program at Eau Claire. Have you been involved in it a lot?
Yeah, I've been pretty much, I wish I had more time to be. Mm-hmm. So I've always been on kind of the periphery of the Women's Studies program, very strongly supportive. I teach cross-listed courses in Native American women's literature. So my Women's Studies majors, the majors and minors in my class can take this for that credit if they need it. Mm-hmm. So we're really, these courses are bountiful because they offer credit for cultural diversity, credit for English majors, and credit also for American Indian Studies majors and minors mm-hmm. as well. I'm writing a course now. I've been planning this. I need to finish it. It's a course in ethnic women's autobiography. And I'm teaching a version of that this semester. I've taught versions of it in the past. But I want to create this course for women's studies so that anyone can step in and teach this course on ethnic women's life writings.
That's very interesting.
So that's the way that I can actively support the women's studies program. Mm-hmm. I have an enormous amount of respect for the work that all of you do. And I'm so appreciative to have those voices in my classroom. Because they can say the things I can't say.
But do you have an example of something like that?
Oh, I had some very strong voices in... It was in an American literature survey course, actually. And we were reading The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton. Mm-hmm. Edith Wharton's... House of Mirth, because House of Mirth is features a protagonist who is struggling to make her way and survive in the world, and she doesn't have quite the class, she doesn't have quite the resources to be where she wants to be socially. So she has some really difficult choices to make in her life, and very few options. I had my students do some supplemental readings from our casebook about the status of women in mid-late 19th century America, looking at different social stratas. My female students were astonished by it, to think that how few opportunities women had to survive, thrive, and maybe even advance themselves in the world without paying a huge price for it. Mm-hmm. And so this, I remember, I had some very strong women's voices in that room, speaking to that framing all of that is social injustice, social and political injustice. Mm-hmm. So they, they could say it, and then the class, and then they're in a way sort of framing the discussion for their classmates as well. Mm-hmm. So anytime, women's studies majors who want to take my course, just encourage them.
What is your first memory of the Women's Studies program?
I've always been aware that there was a Women's Studies minor. And then I remember when Dr. Susan Terrell was being interviewed for a position here, and so I attended a number of interviews with various candidates, simply because I wanted to learn more. Mm-hmm. I wanted to learn more about those women's views and their preparations and their vision for a women's studies program, because a program didn't exist at that time. And then I remember when Susan undertook to create this program, I could identify that, because when I first came here in 1993, we were just at the very beginning of creating an American Indian Studies program and major. So I could appreciate the challenges and the growing pains of that particular unit, and felt a great deal of encouragement that because the administration and the UW system was so supportive, and that there were a very strong core of women educators and students who were supporting and seeing this as a culmination of a vision. So I've been very heartened by that.
Very cool. How has the program changed since your first kind of involvement with it?
It's grown. It's gotten lots of traction in terms of its ability to attract really brilliant faculty and students. In the American Indian Studies program, we're personally jealous because you folks have more space than we do, literally more office space. So,
wow.
So as we look into our future, you know, we're looking at you folks and saying, okay, now we need to, you know, we need to find a way to get this more grassroots support on campus for the work that we're doing. I have a huge amount of respect for what's been accomplished over the years.
What do you consider to be your contributions to the Women's Studies department?
In my teaching, the offering courses that are always balanced with female voices, and offering courses in which female voices are, and female experiences, women's experiences are foregrounded, like the one I'm teaching now, this senior seminar in Native Women's Life Writings. I've never taught it at the senior level before, so it's given me opportunities and really gifted students that I haven't enjoyed in the past. Because I've taught little bits of this course in other places. But to focus exclusively on women's experiences in this particular context has been just a real joy for me. I mean, it's given me more to think about in terms of my own growth as a scholar, thinking about other directions of publication and other texts that I would like to read and bring into the course, the courses I teach. So that's my contribution, I hope, is to sort of broaden the spectrum of women's studies by providing, for the women of color, providing the voice from American Indians.
I think that's really important, too. As you think about the future, what role do you think women's studies will play on the UW-Eau Claire campus, community, or beyond?
I think that it will continue to grow. And I hope that there is a point where the program becomes a department. And with that, the program becomes more equitably positioned in relation to other departments on campus, That that there is a department chair and tenure line specifically in women's studies. And this is our dream also for American Indian Studies. So we, again, you know, you have our great support and admiration for what you do. That's what I envision happening.
As major growth in the department.
Major growth into becoming a department.
Right.
Into becoming a department. I think that's just only a matter of time before that happens.
The sooner the better. I'm rooting for it. Is there anything else you wanted to share about the Women's Studies program on Eau Claire, or anything?
I appreciate your coordinator thinking about, your program director thinking about a series of interviews like this with a lot of different women, to raised the profile of the Women's Studies program on campus in a creative and different kind of way, other than the ways that have usually been planned. I feel honored to participate. I wish you all well.
We appreciate everyone that's helping us in our venture. Mm-hmm. Well, fabulous. Well, thank you for a fabulous interview and sharing your stories and valuable time with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
We are having, because we're making these posters, and I'll send you a draft of it.